plants, seize him, bind his feet, pull him under. He feels himself becoming one with the abyss. He is part of the foam. The waves toss him from one to the other. He gulps down bitterness. The spineless ocean is raring to drown him. The vastness toys with him, dragging out his last gasps. All that water feels like liquid hate. Yet he struggles. He tries to defend himself. He tries to keep going. He makes an effort. He swims. His pitiful strength, immediately exhausted, he struggles against the inexhaustible. Where can the ship have got to? Over there, barely visible in the pale blur of the horizon. Gusts of wind come up. Each head of foam batters him. He looks up, and all he sees is the lividness of the clouds. In his death throes, he witnesses the immense madness of the sea. He is tortured to death by this insanity. He hears sounds unfamiliar to man that seem to come from beyond the earth, from some unimaginable and awful other world. There are birds in the thick cloud cover, just as there are angels hovering over human hardships. But what can they do for him? They fly, sing, and soar, while he moans in agony. He feels buried at once by those two infinities, the ocean and the sky. The one a grave, the other a shroud. Night comes bearing down, and he has been swimming for hours. His strength is almost gone. The ship, that distant speck where once there were men, has faded from view. He is alone in the dreadful crepuscular gulf. He goes under. He is getting stiff. He thrashes around. He feels the monstrous waves of the invisible below him. He calls out. There are no men anymore. Where is God? He calls and calls. Anyone, anyone. He goes on calling. Nothing on the horizon, nothing in the sky. He implores the expanse stretching away, the waves, the seaweed, the rocks. They are all deaf. He pleads with the storm. The imperturbable storm obeys only infinity. Around him, darkness, mist, solitude, the oblivious thundering tumult, the endless chaotic puckering and churning of the wild waters. Inside him, horror and fatigue. Under him, the drop. Nothing to hang on to, no foothold. He thinks of the murky adventures of his corpse falling through the limitless gloom. The bottomless cold paralyzes him. His hands clench and curl up and grasp at nothingness. Winds, clouds, whirlpools, gusts, useless stars, what can he do? The despairing give up. The weary decide to die. They stop resisting. They go with the flow. Let go, and off they go, the drowned rolling away forever in the gloomy depths of engulfment. Oh, relentless march of human society! All the men and souls lost along the way, written off. Ocean into which all those that the law drops fall. Vile withdrawal of all help. Oh, moral death! The sea is that inexorable social darkness into which the penal system casts those it has damned. The sea is measureless misery. The soul, drifting with the current in the plumbless deep, can turn into a corpse. Who will resuscitate it? Fresh grievances. When the time came for him to get out of jail, when Jean Valjean heard in his ear those strange words, "You are free," the moment was unreal, unbelievable. A ray of blinding light, a ray of the real light of the living, suddenly shot through him. But this light swiftly faded. Jean Valjean had been dazzled by the idea of freedom. He had believed in a new life. He very soon saw what kind of freedom a yellow passport entails. And this brought much more bitter disillusionment. He had calculated that what he had saved during his stay in jail amounted to 171 francs. To be fair, we should add that he had forgotten to include in his calculations the fact that Sundays and public holidays were compulsory days off, which, over 19 years, meant deducting around 24 francs. On top of that, his savings had been reduced by various local charges to the sum of 109 francs and 15 sous, which had been counted out and handed over to him as he was leaving. He did not understand any of this and believed himself to have been shortchanged, let's not mince words, robbed. The day after he was released, in Grasse, he saw some men unloading bales of orange blossom outside a distillery. He offered his services. The job was urgent, so they took him on. He set to work. He was smart, robust, and adroit. He did his best, and the foreman seemed happy. But while he was working, a gendarme came past, spotted him, and demanded to see his papers. He had to show his yellow passport. That done, Jean Valjean went back to work. A bit before this, he had quizzed one of the workers about the daily rate they earned for the job. They told him that it was 30 sous. That evening, since he was forced to head out the following morning, he turned up at the distillery foreman's and asked for his pay. The foreman didn't say a word, just handed him 25 sous. He demanded the rest. The foreman replied, "That's good enough for the likes of you." He stood his ground. The foreman looked him in the eyes and said, "Watch out you don't end up back inside." Once more he considered himself robbed. Society, the state, in diminishing his savings, had robbed him in a big way. Now it was the turn of the individual to rob him in a small way. Release is not the same as liberation. You get out of jail, all right, but you never stop being condemned. So that is what happened to him in Grasse. We have seen the welcome he was given in Digne. The man wakes up. And so, as the cathedral clock struck 2 in the morning, Jean Valjean woke up. What woke him up was that the bed was just too good. He had not gone to sleep in a bed for going on 20 years, and although he had not taken his clothes off, the sensation was too novel not to disturb his sleep. He had slept for over 4 hours. His weariness had passed. He was used to not giving many hours over to rest. He opened his eyes and peered into the darkness around him for a while. Then he closed them again to go back to sleep. When your day has been teeming with different sensations, when you have things on your mind, you can get to sleep to start with, but you can't get back to sleep. Sleep comes a lot more easily than it comes back. This was the case with Jean Valjean. He could not get back to sleep, and he began to think. He was in one of those states where our ideas get blurred. There was a sort of cloudy swirling in his brain. His old memories and his most immediate memories floated around pell-mell and bumped into each other at random, losing their shapes, becoming crazily magnified, then evaporating suddenly, like mud stirred up in a pool of water. Many thoughts came to him, but there was one that would not go away and that sent all the others scurrying. This thought, we will tell you without further ado. He had spotted the 6 silver knives and forks and the silver ladle that Madame Magloire had laid on the table. These 6 silver sets of cutlery obsessed him. They were just sitting there, a few feet away. The very moment he crossed the room next door to come into the room he was now in, the old servant had put them away in a cupboard at the head of the bed. He had naturally noted this cupboard, on the right as you enter by the dining room. They were solid silver, and old silver at that. For the ladle, you'd get at least 200 francs, double what he'd earned in 19 years. True, he would have earned more if the administration hadn't robbed him. His mind wavered for a good hour, and his hesitation certainly involved some struggle. The clock struck 3. He opened his eyes again, promptly sat up, shot out his arm and groped for his haversack, which he had thrown into the corner of the alcove, then swung his legs over the side of the bed and placed his feet on the floor, and found himself sitting up straight on the bed, not knowing how he'd got into that position. He remained sitting there in that position, thinking, for some time. And anyone who'd seen him sitting there in the dark, the only person awake in the sleeping household, would have found him a sinister sight. Suddenly he bent down, took off his shoes, and put them gently on the mat beside the bed. Then he resumed his position, sitting still and thinking. In the middle of this vile rumination, the ideas we'd just mentioned kept stirring around in his brain, coming and going and coming back again, seemingly bearing down on him like a ton of bricks. And then, without knowing why, and with that automatic persistence of reverie, he thought at the same time about a convict named Brevet, whom he had known in jail, and whose trousers used to be held up by a single brace of knitted cotton. The checked pattern of that brace kept coming back to him without let-up. He remained sitting there and would perhaps have stayed there like that until daybreak, if the clock had not struck a single note to mark the quarter hour or half hour. The clock seemed to say to him, "Let's go." He rose to his feet, hesitated a moment longer, and listened. All was quiet in the house. So he headed straight for the window, which he could make out, taking small, careful steps. The night was not very dark. There was a full moon with big clouds racing across it, chased by the wind. This produced bursts of light and dark outside, eclipses and lightning flashes, and inside, a sort of twilight. This twilight, enough to guide his path, intermittent because of the clouds, was like the livid light that falls from a basement window when people are coming and going outside. When he reached the window, Jean Valjean looked closely at it. It had no bars. It opened onto the garden, and it was shut, in keeping with the custom of these parts, with only a tiny latch. He opened it, but as cold, sharp air rushed in, he closed it again instantly. He looked at the garden with that penetrating gaze that sizes up more than it sees. The garden was enclosed by a fairly low white wall, easily scaled. Behind it, on the other side, he could make out the tops of trees evenly spaced, which indicated that the wall divided the garden from an avenue or lane planted with trees. Having given the scene the once-over, he acted like a man who knows what he's doing, walked over to his alcove, grabbed his haversack, opened it, fumbled around inside, took out something that he placed on the bed, stuck his shoes in one of his pockets, did the bag up again, hoisted it onto his shoulders, clapped his cap on his head, jamming the peak down over his eyes, felt for his stick, and went and put it in the corner of the window, then returned to the bed and resolutely seized the object he had laid on it. It was a short iron bar, sharpened at one end, like a hunting spear. In the dark it would have been hard to work out what this piece of iron was made for. Was it perhaps a lever? Was it perhaps a club? In daylight you would have recognized that it was just an ordinary miner's spike. In those days, convicts were sometimes put to work quarrying stone from the high hills that surrounded Toulon, and it was not unusual for them to carry around miners' tools. Miners' spikes were made of solid iron, with a point at the bottom end, for hoeing into the rock. He took this spike in his right hand, and, holding his breath and treading softly, he headed for the door of the room next door, the bishop's room, as you'll recall. When he reached the door, he found it ajar. The bishop hadn't closed it. What he does next? Jean Valjean listened. Not a sound. He pushed the door. He pushed it with one finger, lightly, with that furtive, anxious restraint of a cat that wants to come inside. The door yielded to the pressure, silently and imperceptibly opening the gap a little wider. He waited a moment, then pushed the door again, more forcefully. It continued to yield in silence. The gap was wide enough now for him to slip through. But near the door, a small table was in the way, forming, as it did, a sort of awkward angle with the door. Jean Valjean saw the problem, but he had to open the door wider, no matter what. He steeled his resolve and pushed the door a third time, more energetically. This time, A badly oiled hinge suddenly sent out a prolonged and raucous screech into the darkness. Jean Valjean jumped. The noise of the hinge rang in his ears, as resounding and terrible as the trumpet of the Last Judgment. In the eerie amplification of that initial moment, he almost imagined that the hinge had come alive, suddenly taking on a terrible life of its own, and barking a warning to the world like a dog rousing the sleeping from their slumber. He stopped in his tracks, shivering, distraught, and tipped back from the balls of his feet onto his heels. He could hear his pulse thumping in his temples like a pair of sledgehammers, and it seemed to him that his breath came from his chest with the sound the wind makes rushing out of a cave. It seemed to him impossible that the horrible clamor of the outraged hinge had not shaken the whole house like the shock of an earthquake. The door, pushed by him, had taken fright and screamed. The old man would soon be up. The two old women would cry out. Someone would come running to their aid. Before a quarter of an hour was up, the town would be buzzing and the gendarmerie on the move. For a moment, he felt the jig was up. He stayed where he was, petrified like the proverbial pillar of salt, not daring to make a move. Some minutes passed. The door was wide open now. He risked a peek at the room. Nothing had moved. He cocked an ear. Nothing in the house was stirring. The noise of the rusty hinge had woken no one. This initial danger was over, but he still felt a dreadful turmoil inside. Yet he did not back down. Even when he had thought the jig was up, he had not backed down. His only thought now was to get it over with as quickly as possible. He stepped into the room. The room was perfectly still. Here and there, various blurred shapes could vaguely be made out, which by day were papers scattered over the table, open folios, books piled on a stool, an armchair heaped with clothes, and a prie-dieu. But at this hour, they were no more than dark shadows and whitish spots. Jean Valjean crept forward carefully to avoid bumping into the furniture. At the back of the room he could hear the quiet, even breathing of the bishop, fast asleep. Suddenly he stopped. He was on top of the bed before he knew it. It had taken no time at all. Nature sometimes makes connections between our actions and its own special effects and star turns with a sort of somber and intelligent aptness, as though it wanted to make us sit up and think. For nearly half an hour, a huge cloud had covered the sky. The very moment Jean Valjean stopped, facing the bed, this cloud broke up, as though it had done so on purpose. An array of moonlight shot through the long window and suddenly lit up the bishop's pale face. He was sleeping peacefully, untroubled. Though in bed, he was almost fully dressed because of the bitterly cold nights of the lower Alps, decked out in a brown woolen garment that covered his arms to the wrists. His head was thrown back against the pillow in the abandoned attitude of sleep. Over the side of the bed his hand dangled, adorned with his pastoral ring, the hand that had performed so many good works and saintly deeds. His whole face was luminous with a vague expression of contentment, hope, and bliss. It was more than a smile, almost a radiance. On his forehead lay the ineffable reflection of a light invisible to the naked eye. The souls of the just in sleep contemplate a mysterious heaven. A reflection of this heaven lay over the bishop. It was at the same time a luminous transparency, for this heaven was inside him. This heaven was the internal light of his conscience. At the moment that the moonlight superimposed itself, so to speak, on this inner limpidity, the sleeping bishop appeared bathed in glory. And yet that glory remained soft and veiled in an ineffable half-light. The moon in the sky, dozing nature, the garden so still, the house so calm, the hour, the moment, the silence, added something oddly solemn and moving to the venerable rest of this good man. And, wrapped in a sort of majestic and serene aureole, his white hair and those closed eyes, this face, where all was hope and where all was trust. The head of an old man, sleeping like a baby. There was something almost divine about the man. So unself-consciously august was he. Jean Valjean, on the other hand, was in the shadow, his iron spike in hand, standing erect, rigid, terrified at this luminous old man. He had never seen anything like it. Such trust horrified him. The moral world offers no greater sight than this. A troubled and overwrought conscience, brought to the brink of some evil deed, gazing upon the sleep of a just man. Such sleep in such isolation, with only the likes of him for company, had something sublime about it that he was dimly but powerfully aware of. No one could have said what was happening inside him, not even himself. To try to grasp it, we need to imagine the most violent of men in the presence of the most gentle. Even on his face, you could not have made out anything distinct with any certainty. His expression was one of a sort of crazed amazement. He saw what he saw, and that was that. But what was he thinking? It would have been impossible to guess. What was obvious was that he was moved and deeply distressed. But what kind of emotion was that, exactly? He couldn't take his eyes off the old man. The only thing that could clearly be discerned in his demeanor and on his countenance was a strange indecisiveness. You would have said he was hesitating on the brink of two yawning chasms, the one where you are lost and the one where you are saved, doom or salvation. He looked as though he was ready either to smash the old man's skull in or to kiss his hand. After a few moments, Jean Valjean raised his left hand slowly to his forehead and took off his cap, then let his arm fall back just as slowly, and with that he retreated into his thoughts, his cap in his left hand, his club in his right, his hair standing up on end over his savage head. The bishop went on sleeping in profound peace beneath this frightening stare. A reflection of moonlight made the crucifix above the mantelpiece dimly visible. It seemed to be opening its arms to both of them, in benediction for the one and forgiveness for the other. All of a sudden, Jean Valjean clapped his cap back on his head, then strode to the head of the bed without giving the bishop another glance, and straight to the cupboard, which he could make out next to the head of the bed. He raised the miner's spike as though he was about to force the lock, but the key was in it. So he turned it. The first thing he saw was the basket of silverware. He grabbed it, bounded across the room without worrying about the noise, whipped through the door, ran back to the oratory, shoved the window open, grabbed his stick, climbed over the windowsill, threw the silver into his knapsack, flung the basket away, raced across the garden, leaped over the wall like a tiger, and fled. The bishop at work. The next day at sunrise, Monseigneur Bienvenu was circling his garden. Madame Magloire ran to him, quite beside herself. "Monseigneur, Monseigneur," she cried, "does your grace know where the silverware basket is?" "Yes," said the bishop. "God be praised," she replied. "I didn't know what had happened to it." The bishop had just picked the basket from out of a garden bed. He handed it to Madame Magloire. "Here it is." "But," she said, flustered, "there's nothing in it. What about the silver?" "Ah," said the bishop. "So it's the silver you're worried about. I don't know where that is."
"Good God in heaven, it's been stolen. That man from last night, he's stolen it."
In the blink of an eye, with all the sprightliness of a frisky old watchdog, Madame Magloire tore off to the oratory, into the alcove, and back again to the bishop. The bishop had just bent down, heaving a sigh, and was examining a cochlearia d'aiguillon that the basket had broken when it landed in the garden bed. He straightened up again at Madame Magloire's shriek.
"Monseigneur, the man's gone. The silver's been stolen."
While she was yelling the news, her eyes fell on a corner of the garden where you could see traces of a scramble. A brick in the wall had been ripped out.
"Look, that's where he got away. He jumped over into the Ruelle Cochefilet. Ah, the swine, he stole our silver on us."
The bishop remained silent for a moment. Then he looked up with a grave expression on his face and spoke softly to Madame Magloire. "To start with, was the silver really ours?" Madame Magloire was flabbergasted. There was another silence, and then the bishop went on. "Madame Magloire, I was wrong to hang on to that silver, and for so long it belonged to the poor. What was that man? He was poor, evidently."
"God help us," Madame Magloire retorted. "It's not me or Mademoiselle I'm worried about. We couldn't care less. It's Monseigneur. What is Monseigneur going to eat with now?"
The bishop looked at her in amazement. "Ah, is that all? Don't we have any pewter cutlery?" Madame Magloire shrugged her shoulders.
"Pewter smells bad."
"Well, then, iron." Madame Magloire pulled a face.
"Iron tastes bad."
"Well, then, wood." A few moments later, he was eating at the same table that Jean Valjean had sat at the night before. While he ate, Monseigneur Bienvenu chirruped gaily to his sister, who said nothing, and to Madame Magloire, who muttered under her breath that there really was no need for spoons or forks, even of wood, to dunk a bit of bread in a glass of milk.
"Did you ever hear such a thing?"
Madame Magloire said to herself as she came and went.
"Fancy letting a man like that come into your home, and to put him up right next to your own bed. And what a stroke of luck that all he did was steal! Mary, Mother of God, it makes your hair stand on end just thinking about it."
Just as the brother and sister were getting up from the table, there was a knock at the door. "Come in," said the bishop. The door opened. A weird and wild-looking bunch stood on the doorstep. Three men were holding a fourth by the scruff of the neck. The three men were gendarmes. The other man was Jean Valjean. A sergeant of the gendarmerie, who seemed to be the leader of the group, stood nearest the door. He came in and strode over to the bishop, giving him a military salute. "Monseigneur," he began, "at that." Jean Valjean, who looked glum and broken, lifted his eyes, startled. "Monseigneur," he murmured, "so this isn't the local curé?" "Quiet," said one of the gendarmes. "This is Monseigneur the bishop." But Monseigneur Bienvenu had gone over to the men as fast as his old pins would carry him. "Ah, there you are," he cried, looking straight at Jean Valjean. "Am I glad to see you, but heavens, I gave you the candlesticks too, you know. They are made of silver like the rest, and you can get 200 francs for them easily. Why didn't you take them with the cutlery?" Jean Valjean's eyes nearly popped out of his head. He looked at the venerable bishop with an expression no human tongue could convey. "Monseigneur," said the sergeant, "is what this man said true, then? We saw him hot-footing it out of town. He looked like he was on the run. So we arrested him to be on the safe side. He had all this silver, and he told you," the bishop broke in with a smile, "that it had been given to him by some old codger of a priest whose place he'd spent the night in. I can see how it looks. So you've brought him back here? There has been a misunderstanding." "If that's the case," the sergeant said, "can we let him go?" "You must," said the bishop. The gendarmes released Jean Valjean, who visibly shrank back. "Are you really letting me go?" he said in a voice that was barely articulate, as muffled as if he were talking in his sleep. "Yes, we're letting you go. Something wrong with your ears?" said one of the gendarmes. "My dear friend," said the bishop, "before you go, here are your candlesticks. Take them." He went to the mantelpiece, swept up the two silver candlesticks, and handed them over to Jean Valjean. The two women watched the bishop without a word, without a movement, without a glance that might upset him. Jean Valjean's whole body was shaking. He took the two candlesticks automatically and with a stricken look on his face. "Now," said the bishop, "go in peace. Speaking of which, when you come back, my friend, there's no need to go through the garden. You can always come and go through the front door on the street. It is only ever on the latch, night and day." He then turned to the policeman and said, "Gentlemen, you may go." The gendarmes headed off. Jean Valjean looked as though he were about to pass out. The bishop went over to him and said to him in a voice just above a whisper, "Don't forget, don't ever forget, that you promised me to use this silver to make an honest man of yourself." Jean Valjean, who had no memory of ever having promised a thing, remained stunned. The bishop had emphasized every word as he spoke. He went on with a kind of solemnity, "Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil, but to good. It is your soul that I am buying for you. I am taking it away from black thoughts and from the spirit of perdition, and I am giving it to God." Petit Gervais. Jean Valjean left town as though he were still on the run. He practically broke into a trot when he hit the open countryside in his anxiety to get away, blindly taking whatever paths and tracks he stumbled on without realizing that he was going round in circles. He snaked about like this all morning without eating a thing and without feeling in the least hungry. He was in the grip of a whole host of new sensations. He felt a kind of rage he knew not at whom. He couldn't tell whether he felt moved or humiliated. A strange sensation of tenderness came over him at times, but he fought it and threw the hardness of the last 20 years up against it like a screen, warding it off. This state wore him out. He watched in alarm as the kind of frightening calm that the injustice of his lousy fate had produced melted away inside him. He wondered what on earth could take its place. There were moments when he really would have preferred to be slammed behind bars with the gendarmes and for things not to have taken such an incredible turn. At least he wouldn't have been so churned up. Even though the season was fairly advanced, there were still a few late-blooming flowers here and there in the hedges. And as he walked along, clouds of perfume brought back childhood memories. These memories were almost unbearable. It was so long since they had last appeared. A welter of whirring thoughts he could not have put into words banked up inside him like this the whole day. As the sun set at the end of the day, dragging out the shadow on the ground of the tiniest pebble, Jean Valjean sat behind a bush in a great red plain that was absolutely deserted. The only thing on the horizon was the chain of the Alps. Otherwise, not even a church steeple in a distant village. Jean Valjean might have been about 3 miles from Digne. A path that cut through the plain ran past just a few feet from the bush. While he was lost in thought, a meditative state that would have contributed not a little to the frightening effect of his rags on anyone unlucky enough to run into him, he heard a joyful sound. He turned his head and saw a young Savoyard, an itinerant chimney sweep of about 12, skipping along the path, singing, a hurdy-gurdy or viol at his side, and a cherrywood box on his back. He was one of those chirpy little strays that roam the countryside with their knees peeping through the holes in their pants. Still singing, the child paused now and then to play jacks of the few coins he was carrying, his entire fortune probably. One of the coins was a 40-sou piece. The boy stopped beside the bush without spotting Jean Valjean and tossed his handful of sous into the air. Up until that moment, he had caught them all pretty skillfully on the back of his hand. This time, the 40-sou piece eluded him and went rolling toward the bush over to Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean instantly slammed his foot on top of it. But the boy had followed it with his eyes and saw what happened. He was not put out at all and went straight over to the man. The place was completely isolated. As far as the eye could see, there was no one on the plain or walking along the track. The only sound was the feeble cries of a flock of migratory birds flying across the sky at immense height. The boy stood with his back to the sun, which shot through his hair, turning it to threads of spun gold, and flushing the savage face of Jean Valjean with a blood-red glow. "Monsieur," said the little Savoyard, with that childish trust that is a blend of complete ignorance and complete innocence, "my coin?"
"What's your name?"
asked Jean Valjean.
"Petit Gervais, monsieur."
"Get lost," said Jean Valjean.
"Monsieur," the child persisted, "give me back my coin." Jean Valjean lowered his head and did not respond. The child repeated, "My coin, monsieur."
Jean Valjean went on staring at the ground.
"My coin," cried the child. "My silver coin, I want my money."
Jean Valjean seemed not to have heard him, or to understand plain French. The boy grabbed him by the collar and shook him, at the same time trying hard to shift the great hobnailed boot from off his treasure.
"I want my piece, my 40-sou piece."
The child began to cry. Jean Valjean's head shot up. He was still squatting on the ground. His eyes looked troubled. He examined the boy with a sort of wonder. Then he reached for his stick and yelled in a terrible voice, "Who's there?"
"Me, monsieur," the boy replied. "Please, Javert, me. Me, give me back my 40 sous, please. Take your foot away, monsieur, please."
Then, tiny as he was, the boy lost his temper and managed to sound almost threatening.
"For pity's sake, will you take your foot away? Take your foot away right now."
"Ah, you're still here," said Jean Valjean.
And suddenly, springing up, foot still on the coin, he added,
"I'd get cracking if I was you."
The terrified child looked at him, and then began to quiver from head to toe, and after a few seconds of standing there stunned, he ran away, as fast as his little legs would carry him, not daring to look back or to let out a whimper. But after a certain distance he was out of breath and forced to stop, and Jean Valjean, lost in a daze as he was, heard him sobbing. A few seconds later the boy had vanished. The sun had gone down. The shadows gathered around Jean Valjean. He hadn't eaten all day. It is likely that he had a fever. He stayed on his feet, rooted to the spot, not having budged since the boy fled. His chest heaved as he breathed slowly and unevenly. His eyes were riveted to a spot 10 or 12 feet ahead, as though he were completely fixated on a shard of old blue pottery lying in the grass. Suddenly he shuddered. He had begun to feel the cold night air. He pulled his cap down over his forehead, fumbled mechanically to do up his smock, took a step forward and stooped to pick his stick up off the ground. At that moment he spotted the 40-sou coin that he had half ground into the dirt with his foot and that was glistening among the pebbles. The sight of it was a bolt from the blue.
"What the hell is that?"
he hissed between clenched teeth. He took a few steps back, without being able to take his eyes off the spot he had trampled underfoot only a moment before, as though the thing shining there in the darkness were an open eye staring up at him. After a few moments he lunged convulsively at the coin, snatched it off the ground, and stood holding it motionless, staring off into the farthest reaches of the plain, casting his eye at all points along the horizon, upright and shivering like a frightened wild animal looking for a place to hide. He couldn't see a thing. Night was coming down. The plain was cold and murky. Great violet mists were swirling up in the glimmering twilight. He let out an "ah!" and set off at a fast pace in the direction the child had taken before he disappeared. After 100 feet or so he stopped and looked around, but still saw nothing. Then he called out at the top of his lungs,
"P'tit Gervais! P'tit Gervais!"
He shut his mouth and waited. No one answered. The countryside was deserted and mournful. He was surrounded on all sides by empty space. There was nothing all around but semi-darkness, in which his gaze was lost, and silence, in which his voice was lost. A freezing northerly wind was blowing, the icy blast of winter lending the things around him a sort of woeful life. Stunted shrubs shook their skinny little limbs in unbelievable fury. You would have sworn they were threatening someone and chasing after him. He started walking again, and then he started running, from time to time stopping and calling out in the lonely wilderness in the most fearsome and the most desolate voice you could possibly imagine,
"P'tit Gervais! P'tit Gervais!"
Naturally, if the boy had heard him, he'd have been frightened stiff and quickly ducked for cover. But the child was already, no doubt, far away. He ran into a priest on horseback and went up to him and said,
"Monsieur le curé, have you seen a boy go by?"
"No," said the priest. "Kid by the name of P'tit Gervais. I haven't seen a soul."
He took 2 5-franc pieces out of his bag and handed them to the priest.
Monsieur Curé, for your pool. Monsieur Curé, he's just a little kid of about 10, with a wooden box on his back, I think, and a hurdy-gurdy. He was heading this way, one of the chimney-sweep kids, a Savoyard, you know.
I haven't seen him.
Petit Gervais, he's not from any of the villages around here, is he? Can't you tell me?
If it's as you say, my friend, the boy must be a foreigner. They come through here in droves. We haven't a clue who they are.
Jean Valjean swiftly produced 2 more 5-franc pieces and handed them to the priest.
For your poor, he said.
Then he added, on a wild note,
Monsieur Abbé, arrest me. I am a thief.
The priest dug his heels in and galloped away, frightened out of his wits. Jean Valjean started to run again in the direction he had first taken. He ran on for quite some distance, peering around, calling out, shouting. But he met no one. 2 or 3 times he ran towards something off the beaten track that looked to him like someone lying down or crouching. It always turned out to be a clump of brushwood or a flat outcrop of rock. At last, where 3 paths intersected, he stopped. The moon had risen. He strained to see in the distance and called one last time,
Petit Gervais! Petit Gervais!
His cry died out in the mist without even raising an echo. He mumbled once more,
Petit Gervais!
But his voice was weak now, barely a murmur. That was a last-ditch attempt. His legs suddenly gave way beneath him as if an invisible power had suddenly bowled him over with the weight of his guilty conscience. He dropped, exhausted, onto a big slab of rock, his hands balled into fists and buried in his hair, his head propped on his knees, and he cried,
I am a miserable bastard.
His heart broke at that point, and he burst into tears. It was the first time he had cried in 19 years. When Jean Valjean left the bishop's, as we saw, he was in a state far beyond anything he had ever experienced till that moment. He did not recognize himself. He could not make sense of what was happening to him. He steeled himself against the old man's angelic act and against his gentle words. You promised me to make an honest man of yourself. It is your soul that I am buying for you. I am taking it away from the spirit of perversity, and I am giving it to the good Lord. Those words kept coming back to him. He defended himself against such heavenly forgiveness by means of pride, which is like a stronghold of evil inside us. He felt indistinctly that the old priest's forgiveness was the greatest assault and the most deadly attack he had ever been rocked by, that if he could resist such clemency, his heart would be hardened once and for all, that if he gave in to it, he would have to give up the hate that the actions of other men had filled his heart with for so many years, and which he relished, that this time he had to conquer or be conquered, and that the struggle, a colossal and decisive struggle, was now on between his own rottenness and the goodness of that man. In the glimmering light of all these thoughts, he staggered like a drunk. While he was flailing about, did he have any real idea what his adventure in Digne might mean for him? Did he hear all those mysterious warning bells that alert us or jog our spirits at certain turning points in life? Was there a voice that whispered in his ear that he had just passed the most solemn moment of his destiny, that there was no longer a middle course for him, that from now on he would either be the best of men or he would be the worst of men, that he now had to rise higher, so to speak, than the bishop or fall even lower than the galley slave, that if he wanted to be good, he had to be an angel, that if he wanted to stay bad, he had to be a monster from hell. Here, once more, we need to ask those questions we have already asked elsewhere. Did some dim notion of all this take shape in his mind? Certainly, as we've said before, adversity sharpens the wits, and calamity is the highest form of education. Yet it is doubtful that Jean Valjean was in any state to unravel all the strands we have singled out here. If such notions occurred to him, He would have half-glimpsed them rather than clearly seen them, and they would only have thrown him into a painful and very nearly agonizing crisis. When he had just gotten out of that ugly, dark, deforming place we call jail, the bishop had wounded his soul the way a sudden flash of blinding light would have hurt his eyes coming out of the dark. His future life, the life that opened up to him now, all pure and radiant, filled him with trembling and fear. He no longer really knew where he was. Like an owl suddenly confronted by sunrise, the convict had been dazzled and blinded by virtue. One thing was certain, and he himself did not doubt it, that he was no longer the same man, that already everything about him had changed, and it was no longer in his power to act as though the bishop had not spoken to him, had not touched him to the quick. In this frame of mind, he had encountered Petit Gervais and stolen his 40 sous from him. Why? It was way beyond his powers to explain. Was it the final effect, a last-ditch attempt on the part of the bad thoughts that he had brought with him from jail, a lingering residue of evil impulse, a result of what is called in physics cumulative energy? It was that, and it was also, perhaps, something less than that. To put it simply, it was not he who had stolen. It was not the man, it was the beast who, out of habit and instinct, had stupidly stuck its foot over the money while his mind tried to grapple with so many new and bewildering obsessions. When his mind snapped out of it and saw what the brute had done, Jean Valjean recoiled in anguish and let out a cry of horror. The thing is, and it's a strange phenomenon, one that could not occur outside the situation he was now in. In stealing the money from that child, he had done something he was already no longer capable of. Be that as it may, this final bad deed had a decisive effect on him. It suddenly pierced through the chaos in his mind and cleared it, rolling the blanket of darkness to one side and making way for the light on the other. And it acted on his soul, in the state in which it found itself, the way certain chemical reactants act on a cloudy solution by precipitating one element and clarifying another. At first, before he had time to think, lost as he was, like a drowning man clutching at straws, he had tried to find the child to give him back his money. Then, when he realized that this was pointless and impossible, he gave way to despair. The very moment he shouted, "I am a miserable bastard," he saw himself for what he was, and he was already so dissociated from himself that he felt he was now no more than a ghost. What he saw in front of him, in flesh and blood, with his stick in his hand and his smock on his back and his sack filled with stolen goods over his shoulder, with his grim and granite-like face and his mind full of abominable schemes, was the hideous galley slave, Jean Valjean. Too much misery, as we have noted, had turned him into something of a visionary. And this was like a vision. He truly saw this Jean Valjean, that sinister face before him. He was on the point of asking himself who this man was, and he was horrified. His brain was in one of those states that are both violent and yet frighteningly calm, in which thought runs so deep it blots out reality. You no longer see the objects around you, yet you can see the shapes in your mind as though they are outside your body. And so he contemplated himself, so to speak, face to face. And at the same time, through this hallucination, he saw at a mysterious distance a sort of light, which he took at first to be a torch. Looking more closely at this light that dawned in his conscience, he saw that it had a human shape, that the torch was the bishop. His conscience considered each of the two men in turn as they stood before him, side by side, the bishop and Jean Valjean. Any lesser person than the first would have failed to soften the second. Through one of those strange effects that are peculiar to this kind of ecstasy, the longer the trance went on, the bigger and greater the bishop grew, and the more he shone resplendent in his eyes, the more Jean Valjean shriveled and faded away. At a certain point, he was no more than a shadow. Then, all of a sudden, he evaporated completely. The bishop alone remained. He flooded the entire soul of this miserable bastard with a glorious radiance. Jean Valjean cried for a long time. He shed hot tears, he sobbed, more helpless and fragile than any woman, more terrified than any child. While he was crying, day dawned brighter and brighter in his spirit, and it was an extraordinary light, a light at once ravishing and terrible. His past life, his initial downfall, his long atonement, his increasingly brutal outside appearance, his hardening interior, his release from custody, jollied along by so many schemes of revenge, what had happened to him at the bishop's, the last thing he had done, stealing 40 sous from a child, a crime even more cowardly and monstrous for coming after the bishop's pardon, all this came back to him clearly, but with a clarity he had never before that moment known. He looked at his life, and it looked horrible to him. At his soul, and it looked revolting. And yet a new day was dawning, and its soft light was settling over his life and over his soul. He felt like he was seeing Satan in the light of paradise. How many hours did he spend crying his heart out? What did he do when he stopped crying? Where did he go? No one ever knew. The only thing that is known, apparently, is that that same night, the coach driver who made the Grenoble run got to Digne at around 3 in the morning, and saw, as he drove along the street where the bishop's residence was, a man who looked like he was praying on his knees on the cobblestones in the shadows outside Monseigneur Bienvenu's front door. Book 3. In the year 1817. The year 1817. 1817 is the year that Louis XVIII, with a certain royal aplomb not devoid of arrogance, called the 22nd year of his reign. It is the year Monsieur Bruguière de Sorsomme, the translator of Shakespeare, became famous. All the wig-makers' shops, hoping for the return of powdered wigs, along with the royal bird, were awash with azure and fleur-de-lis. It was the age of innocence, when the Comte Lange sat every Sunday as churchwarden in the official pew at Saint-Germain-des-Prés, decked out as a peer of France, with his red sash and his long beak, and that majestic profile peculiar to a man who has done a remarkable deed. The remarkable deed performed by Monsieur Lange was that, as mayor of Bordeaux, he had handed the town over a little too soon to Monsieur le Duc d'Angoulême on March 12, 1814. Hence his peerage. In 1817 it was all the rage to bury the heads of little boys from 4 to 6 years old under enormous tanned leather caps with ear flaps, which looked rather like Eskimo cowls. The French army was dressed in white, Austrian style. The regiments were known as legions, and instead of numbers they wore the names of departments. Napoleon was on St. Helena, and as England refused his request for green cloth, he was having his old riding habits turned. In 1817, Pellegrini sang, Mademoiselle Bicottini danced, Potier reigned, Audrey did not yet exist. Madame Saqui took over from Forioso. There were still Prussians in France. Monsieur de Lalo was somebody. Legitimacy reared its ugly head, first by cutting off the hand, then the head of Plénier, Corbonneau, and Talleyrand. The Prince de Talleyrand, Grand Chamberlain, and the Abbé Louis, Finance Minister Designate, looked at each other and laughed the laugh of a pair of soothsayers, both having celebrated the Mass of the Federation in the Champ de Mars on July 14, 1790, Talleyrand saying the Mass as bishop, Louis serving him as deacon. In 1817, on the footpaths that laced the same Champ de Mars, big wooden cylinders were to be seen, lying on their sides on the grass, rotting in the rain, their blue paint still bearing traces of eagles and bees that were losing their gold leaf. These were the columns that, 2 years previously, had supported the Emperor's podium in the Champ de Mai. They were scorched and charred here and there by the bivouac fires of the Austrians, camped in barracks close to Gros Caillou. Two or three of the columns had disappeared altogether in these fires, which warmed the great hands of the Kaiserlichen or Imperialists. What was remarkable about the Champ de Mars celebration was that it was held on the Champ de Mars and in the month of June. In the year 1817, two things were popular, the Touquet edition of Voltaire and the Touquet snuffbox à la Charte. The latest Paris sensation was the murder committed by Dautun, who had hurled his brother's head into the Marché aux Fleurs fountain. The Ministry of the Navy was beginning to be questioned over the sinking of the doomed frigate, the Medusa, an event that was to cover the Captain Chaumerex with shame and the painter Géricault with glory. Colonel Selve went to Egypt to become Soliman Pasha there. The Palais des Termes, in the Rue de la Harpe, served as a cooper's shopfront. You could still see on the roof of the Hôtel de Cluny's octagonal tower the little clapboard shed that had served as an observatory to Messier, naval astronomer to Louis XVI. The Duchesse de Duras read the unpublished manuscript of Ourika to three or four friends in her boudoir, done out by X in sky-blue satin. The ends were all scratched out at the Louvre. The Pont d'Austerlitz abdicated and called itself the Pont du Jardin du Roi, a double riddle that disguised both the Pont d'Austerlitz and the Jardin des Plantes. Louis XVIII, who was busily annotating Horace with his thumbnail, and worrying about heroes who get themselves made emperors and clog-makers who get themselves made dauphins, had two causes for concern, Napoleon and Mathurin Bruneau. The Académie Française proposed an essay prize on this theme, the happiness that comes from study. Monsieur Bellard was officially eloquent. Perrault's future attorney general could be seen germinating in his shadow before becoming, when ripe, the butt of Paul-Louis Courier's sarcasm. A Chateaubriand impersonator named Marchangy popped up, followed by a Marchangy impersonator named D'Arincourt. Claire d'Albe and Malek Adel were masterpieces, and Madame Cotin was declared the premier writer of the age. The Institut de France let the academician Napoleon Bonaparte be struck off its list of members. A royal ordinance established a naval school at Angoulême, for the Duc d'Angoulême being a grand admiral of the fleet. It was obvious that the town of Angoulême had to be found by rights to have all the qualities of a seaport, failing which the whole principle of monarchy would have been dented. Ministerial councils fretted over the issue of whether the vignettes of acrobatics that spiced up Franconi's posters and lured the street rabble should be tolerated. Monsieur Payer, author of L'Agnese, a good old fellow with a square face and a wart on one cheek, directed the small private concerts offered by the Marquise de Sassanet, rue de la Ville-l'Évêque. All the young girls sang L'Ermite de Saint-Evelle, with words by Edmond Géraud. The Nain Jaune turned into the Miroir. The Café Lamblin was for the Emperor as opposed to the Café Valois, which was for the Bourbons. Monsieur le Duc de Berry had just been married off to a Sicilian princess, though the Duke was already regarded most darkly by Louvel. Madame de Stael had been dead a year. The bodyguards hissed and booed Mademoiselle Mars. The big newspapers were quite small. The format had shrunk, but freedom of expression had mushroomed. The Constitutionnel was constitutional. The Minerve spelled Chateaubriand, Chateaubriand, like the steak, and that final T gave the bourgeoisie a lot of laughs at the great writer's expense. In the turncoat press, old newspaper hacks prostituted themselves and insulted the outlaws of 1815. David had lost his talent, Arnaud had lost his wit, Carnot had lost his integrity, Soult had never won a battle, and certainly Napoleon had lost his genius. Everyone knows that letters addressed to a man in exile rarely reach him, the police making it a religious duty to intercept them. This is nothing new. Descartes complained about it when he was banished. But when David moaned about not receiving the letters people wrote to him in the columns of some Belgian newspaper, the royalists found this hilarious and jeered at the exile in their rags. Whether you said regicides or voters, enemies or allies, Napoleon or Bonaparte divided you from the next man more decisively than any yawning chasm. All reasonable people agreed that the age of revolutions had been closed forever by King Louis XVIII, fondly known as the immortal author of the Charter. On the tip of the central island by the Pont Neuf, the word Redivivus was sculpted on the pedestal that awaited the statue of Henry IV. In the Rue Thérèse, number 4, Monsieur Pitt was hatching his plans for the consolidation of the monarchy. In critical situations, the leaders of the right invariably wheeled out the phrase, "We must write to Baco." The ultra-royalists, Messieurs Canuel, O'Mahony, and de Chapdelaine, were working not entirely without the approbation of Monsieur the King's brother on what would later become known as the Waterside Conspiracy. The ex-army officers of L'Épingle Noire were also plotting away. De La Verdurie teamed up with Trogoff. Monsieur Decazes, showing somewhat liberal tendencies as police minister, prevailed. Chateaubriand, on his feet every morning at the window at number 27 Rue Saint-Dominique, in stirrup pants and slippers, his grey hair tied up in a Madras scarf, his eyes glued to a mirror, a complete dental surgeon's kit open in front of him, was cleaning his teeth, which were perfect, while dictating variations on Le Monarchie selon la Charte to his secretary, Monsieur Piloge. The most influential critics preferred Lafont to Talma. Monsieur de Feletz signed himself A, Monsieur Hoffmann signed Z. Charles Nodier wrote Thérèse Aubert. Divorce was abolished, high schools were called colleges, the college students, sporting decorative gold fleur-de-lis on their collars, thrashed each other over the King of Rome. The palace secret police informed Her Royal Highness Madame about the portrait, everywhere on show, of Monsieur le Duc d'Orléans, who looked better in the uniform of a Colonel General of Hussars than Monsieur le Duc de Berry in the uniform of a Colonel General of Dragoons, which was a real worry. The city of Paris dipped into its own coffers to have the dome of the Invalides regilded. Serious men wondered what Monsieur de Trinquelague would do on such and such an occasion. Monsieur Clausel de Montal differed on this or that point with Monsieur Clausel de Coussergues. Monsieur de Salaberry was not happy. The actor Picard, who belonged to the Académie, which Molière had never been able to get into, put on Le Duc Philibert at the Odéon, on the pediment of which, though the letters had been torn off, you could still clearly read Théâtre de l'Impératrice. You were either for Cugnet de Montarlot or against him. Favier was seditious, Bavoux was revolutionary. The bookseller Pellissier brought out an edition of Voltaire under the title The Works of Voltaire by the Académie Française. That brings the customers in, the naive publisher reckoned. Popular opinion had it that Monsieur Charles Loison would turn out to be the genius of the century. Envy was beginning to nip at his heels, a sure sign of glory, and he was the butt of this line of verse. Even when Loison takes wing, you know his paws are firmly on the ground. Cardinal Fesch refused to step down, so Monsieur Dupin, Archbishop of Amasie, took over the administration of the Diocese of Lyon. The fight over the Valley of Dappe kicked off between France and Switzerland with a memo from Captain Dufour, who was later made a general. Saint-Simon, then unknown, was busy constructing his sublime dream. At the Académie des Sciences, there was a celebrated Fourier, whom posterity has forgotten, and, in some godforsaken attic or other, there was a Fourier the future will remember. Lord Byron was beginning to shine. A note in a poem of Millevoye's introduced him to France as a certain Lord Baron. David d'Angers tried to knead marble. The Abbé Caron spoke with praise in a small committee of seminarists in the cul-de-sac of the Fruyantine of an unknown priest named Félicité Robert, who was later known as Lamennais. A thing that smoked and sloshed along the Seine with a noise like a dog swimming came and went beneath the windows of the Tuileries from the Pont Royal to the Pont Louis XV. It was a crummy bit of machinery, a sort of toy, the invention of a daydreaming crackpot, a utopia. In a word, a steamboat. Parisians regarded the useless object with indifference. Monsieur de Vaublanc, an Institut de France reformer whose preferred tools were the coup d'état, the royal decree, and the lot, proved to be the making of several academicians, but did not manage to become one himself. The Faubourg Saint-Germain and the Pavillon Marsan wanted Monsieur de Lavaux as chief of police because of his devoutness. Dupuytren, André Camier, argued in the amphitheatre of the École